For guys, size matters. But bigger is definitely not better for guys with overdeveloped breasts. The condition is called gynecomastia, and Dr. Frank Lista of the Plastic Surgery Clinic can help. Dr. Lista is a world-renowned plastic surgeon who has perfected the procedure that corrects gynecomastia with virtually no scarring. Visit theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca and size up your options for downsizing male breasts. theplasticsurgeryclinic.ca.
When he's not writing, he's on the radio. When he's not on the radio, he's writing. When he's not writing or on the radio, well, we've only left him the two options, so he's not allowed to do anything else. This is the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show. Don't forget Hockey Central at noon. They will be joined by Garrett Sparks, the mayor of Toronto. Well, it's probably overstating it, but certainly one of the big stories in the city after a shutout in his NHL debut last night against the Edmonton Oilers. The first goaltender in the history of the Leafs to earn a shutout in his NHL debut. Again, he will join Hockey Central at noon, which will follow this show. Sportsnet 1 will carry the Lakers and 76ers game tonight. Now, normally, if you take a look at the standings, you're probably saying, Jeff, Lakers 76ers, could there be a worse matchup? The difference is, tonight will be Kobe Bryant's final hometown game. I think we're safe in assuming the Lakers and Sixers won't meet each other in the finals. Kobe Bryant announcing that he will retire at the end of the season. Howard Beck is a national basketball writer for Bleacher Report. He was a basketball writer at the LA Daily News from 1997 to 2004. His first year on the beat in LA, I believe, would have been Kobe Bryant's second year in the NBA. Howard, am I correct in that?
Yeah, that is the case. Started in 97, Kobe's second season.
What was the Kobe Bryant you knew in 1997 and covered in 1997 like compared to the Kobe Bryant we see now? And even compared to the Kobe Bryant you knew when you left in 2004?
You know, a lot about him is exactly what we know of him now. Maybe the focus wasn't as sharp. Maybe we didn't know the depths of it all. But in terms of the defining traits of Kobe Bryant, the defining traits of his career, what was clear to me from day one in 97 when I first got on the Laker beat was that this kid was supremely confident, had, you know, that swagger about him, not always arrogant swagger. That came, I think, a little later, but had certainly a supreme confidence about him, about what he could do. And he had this, from day one, incredible work ethic, this dedication to the game, this tunnel vision. And, you know, he knew exactly what he wanted. And it was one of his teammates told me a few years in at one point that Kobe had a list. I don't know if it was like literally a written list or it was just in his head, but he had a list of goals, everything he wanted to get, number of championships, number of MVPs, scoring titles, whatever it was, he knew exactly what he wanted to get out of his career. So all of those things were evident from day one. I think if there's anything that was a little different, and obviously, you know, any of us at age, you know, I think he was 19 by the time I met him. At that point, you know, obviously he's, you know, he's still maturing. He's still growing. He's, you know, he's single. He's a teenager. He's, he had this brightness about him, his personality. And so, like, the darker part of Kobe, the Black Mamba stuff that he, you know, that identity he assumed later on, and a lot of the harshness of Kobe, the hard edges, those came later. At 19, he was still, you know, bright-eyed and just, looking ahead to all these great things that he thought he could accomplish and would accomplish, and just had a lot of personality to him. Was a very positive kid. Was great to be around. Was great with the media. And there's a story I've told occasionally about, maybe a second, third year in, where, before things had gotten tough with Shaq and everything else, and before, he had to deal with a lot of the tensions that we now know about, Kobe was a guy who, before he left practice, if your back was turned, occasionally he'd say, "Hey, Howard, you need me today?" Mm-hmm. Like, checking in before going to the locker room to go leave, for the day, to make sure that we, we got what we needed or if we needed him that day. So he had this courtesy about him. He liked to talk. He liked engaging with the media. And to this day, it's interesting with his announcement of retiring at the end of the season, and he talked again about how he loves to tell stories. He's a storyteller, and that's part of what he's going to pursue post-career, whether that's documentaries, whatever that path may be. And it makes sense to me that Kobe Bryant now fashions himself as a storyteller as well, because he can tell a narrative or construct a narrative as well as a lot of people in my business. He gets it. He understands, how to engage people, on many levels.
Howard Beck's a national basketball writer for Bleacher Report. When do you think that harder edge started to manifest itself? Was it a reaction to those rape allegations, and the subsequent out-of-court settlement? Or did we see signs even before then?
No, signs are earlier than that. I mean, there's a number of events over the course of Kobe's first 5 to 10 years in the league that I think start to shape him a little, and maybe bring out some of that harder edge. I mean, Shaq was rough on him from day one, and so I think he had to develop a little bit of a defense mechanism there. And then the tensions with Shaq, which, that was an up and down thing. There were days they loved each other, days they hated each other. Maybe love is too strong. Hate mm-hmm. was probably not too strong. But there were, it was not a linear thing with them. But that relationship and that tension there, and the tensions that it created in the locker room, that was part of it. Because Kobe then had to stand up for himself, assert himself in a way that was difficult. Then there's, the relationship with his parents, which, as we know, they were estranged for a time. He fired Arne Tellem, his first agent. So there were relationships that got frayed in the first, in that first five to 10 year span, mm-hmm. that I think were part of it too, where, he's a kid in his early 20s. He's a multimillionaire. He's one of the NBA's biggest stars, and he's just trying to find his way personally and professionally. So there were some tensions there, and I think those things started to shape him. And then, obviously, the sexual assault case in Colorado, he pulls back even further. But once that case was resolved, with, I believe, an out-of-court settlement in 2005, what we've seen in the last 10 years of Kobe's career is a guy who, reemerged. I think he pulled back for a time, got a little bit edgy, testy with, not just media, by the way, but with, longtime Lakers staffers who he'd known forever. There were a lot of relationships that got damaged to various extents. And then I think he's patched a lot of that up again in this latter stage of his career, where he is, just kind of become comfortable with who he is professionally, everything that he's accomplished. He got to finally assume that leadership role with the Lakers once Shaq was gone, and he got to lead them back to the finals and two more championships with Pau Gasol. So like anybody, over a 20-year span, there have been a lot of different stages of maturation.
What was the root cause of the whole Shaquille Kobe dynamic and why it went so wrong?
People like to seize on the obvious part, which is that, this was just, as Shaq and Kobe said in Shaq's podcast several weeks ago, that it was this alpha dog wrestling match about who had control of the team and shots and all that stuff. I never would dismiss that, because that was obviously a large part of it. But to me, what it really came down to was that these guys were just opposites in so many ways. Shaq was the life of the party in the locker room, the big jokester. I mean, here he was years older than Kobe. Kobe was the more mature of the two of them. Maybe not, you know, fully formed in terms of an emotional maturity, but Kobe was the one who was the more, you know, focused, responsible, on-task guy. Shaq was the life of the party and the clown of the locker room. Obviously, there's the physical differences and then styles of play. Shaq, there was certainly some jealousy from day one. Shaq used to always say, you know, he accused the media and fans of always falling in love with the flashy guards. Like, he resented it as a big man that no matter how great he was, he would never get quite the adulation that you know, the flashy guards, the Michael Jordan types, of which Kobe was obviously a clone, that they got. But at its core, to me, the biggest thing was simply the fact that Kobe, as we all know, works his tail off, was completely dedicated to improving his game every day of the year, and Shaq was not quite so dedicated. Shaq was the one who would come into camp out of shape every year. Shaq was the one who got the toe surgery in September and was still recovering during training camp, saying, well, you know, I'm doing it on company time, not my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that difference in dedication to the game, I think, frustrated Kobe more than anything, because it was like, look, if you're not going to work for it, why should you be the number one option here? Why should this be your team? Why should you be the one up for MVP honors every year instead of me if I'm the one who's putting in all the time and all the work? I think that frustration for Kobe was paramount. And then all the other things kind of revolve around that, including, as I say, you know, the shot distribution and, you know, who's the number one option.
Yeah, Howard, we've seen athletes in every sport kind of go through their final season. Sometimes it plays out well, sometimes it doesn't. But I don't know if I can remember an athlete whose announcement that he was in his final year was greeted with such a, you know, on the one hand, I mean, those of us who watched Kobe, we loved a lot of the things about his game. We don't like a lot of what we've seen from his game in recent years. But there seems to be such a difference of opinion here. You know, there are people who are, well, thank God Kobe's shutting it down because his game's deteriorating. But there seem to be people who are really willing to put a real negative spin on this, you know, what this retirement's going to be like. How uncomfortable is that going to be, do you think, for the Lakers, for Kobe, you know, and maybe for the rest of us?
You know, I haven't seen a lot of that negativity. And, you know, when Kevin Durant went off yesterday, my first thought was, who is he talking about?
Okay.
I mean, look, I'm on Twitter way too much, like all of us are these days. And I see plenty of fan snark, for sure. Some media snark, but I haven't seen any overwhelming negativity from the media, especially the NBA media. Now, if we want to talk about, you know, TV talking heads or mm-hmm. radio talking heads or others out there whose job is to simply have hot takes on everything, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are mocking Kobe or saying he should have shut it down years ago or should retire now, should retire 5 minutes ago. But I have no doubt that's out there. But especially among the NBA media, people mm-hmm. who cover the game day in, day out, my peers, I don't know who that would be. If Kevin Durant's got a list, if you've got a list, or mm-hmm. a citation somewhere, I'd like to see it, because I just don't think there's been a ton of that. Now, any of us who cover the game, and especially those of us who appreciate what Kobe has represented, what he's accomplished, is it hard to watch now? Of course it is. You know, does anybody want to see him going, you know, 0 for 9 from the arc and shooting air balls and just struggling to be competitive? No, nobody wants to see that. But the idea that but that's just a fact. Like, you can't avoid that. His shooting selection and his shooting results, his playing results, are what they are. They're unavoidable. But is that a platform for people to take cheap shots? I'm sure there are some who have. I just haven't seen a lot of that. But it will be interesting these months to come how people will look at it. I think that Kobe's decision to finally announce, yes, this will be it, helps, because the people's natural reaction to him continuing to plot on, at least you know there's an end an end here. There's a finish line, and people will look at it in a different context. This is the farewell tour now, and whatever that farewell tour represents, even if it's just a chance for a sentimental journey for him and for fans, fine. The Lakers aren't going anywhere anyway.
Howard, I appreciate you doing this. Thank you so much.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Howard Beck is the national basketball writer for Bleacher Report. He covered the Lakers from 1994 to 2007. That would have been great. Covered the Lakers from 1997 to 2004. So he was there as of Kobe Bryant's second year and through the Shaq years as well. And we appreciate Howard Beck joining us again. We will have tonight on Sportsnet 1 at 7 p.m. the Lakers and 76ers. It will be Kobe Bryant's final hometown game. Nick Van Exel is assistant coach of the Texas Legends. They are the Dallas Mavericks D-League affiliate, former teammate of Kobe Bryant's. In Kobe Bryant's early years, Nick Van Exel joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Nick, thanks so much for doing this, man.
No problem.
What are your thoughts? What were your thoughts when Kobe announced that this was going to be his final year, and maybe even your thoughts on the way he went about doing it?
Honestly, me being in Kobe's position as far as being a player and getting towards the end, I probably thought he probably should have done it probably a little bit sooner, but I understand that, you know, our brain and our mental tells us we can, you know, continue to go at that high level. And our body, of course, doesn't let us do that. And, you know, when Kobe, I guess, you know, getting all the flack and realizing that he probably, you know, didn't have a championship team. And, you know, he was just exuding so much energy and it was just probably just draining him is when he just realized that, you know what, it's time for me to hang it up. And, you know, he had a great career. It was a great honor to play with him for 2 years. But, you know, he's definitely going down as one of the greatest players of all time.
Nick Van Exel's head coach of the Texas Legends, the D-League affiliate of the Dallas Mavericks. What was young Kobe like to play with as a teammate and as a guy on the court?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of comes full circle.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when we had a team, well, our team, when Kobe first got there, I wouldn't say we were like 7-8 years in the league. We were still kind of young, but a few of us have been through those wars already. And, you know, we kind of understood it a little bit better than Kobe did at that time. And, you know, we don't think Kobe was ready to play his first, you know, couple years in the league, but he was a great player. We already knew that. But for the NBA, he wasn't ready. So he needed those couple years to develop. And when you look at his team now, he gets frustrated at the young players. So, you know, we sit back and like, well, you know, that's kind of how we felt at the time, you know, because Kobe wasn't ready, but we knew that he was going to be a special player. There was no doubt about that. And, you know, this thing just comes full circle, man. And it's, you know, and that's what it is for Kobe right now.
You know, Nick, Howard Beck made the point that, you know, a lot of people kind of view Kobe as a guy who developed a bit of an edge as he got older, and compared to a guy who came in, you know, as you say, he came as a teenager. He was a young guy. He had a lot thrown on his plate. Did he undergo, you know, what explained the change in him from your point of view? And was it much of a change? Or, Nick, was it just, you know what, a defense mechanism that you normally throw up when, you know, you're the alpha dog in a big market and a big team?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when Kobe first came into the league, he was already cocky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had his thing was he was the best one-on-one player in the league. And, you know, that's what he lived on. That's what he, you know, hung his shoes on. And honestly, he probably was. You know, I mean, he used to do us so bad in practice, it didn't make any sense. And when he got a chance to display it, you know, during game times, he did it, whether it was through the offense or whether it was just, you know, just straight one-on-one. And he's always been cocky. He's always had that swag, you know. And, you know, one thing about Kobe is just always kind of been to himself.
Mm.
You know, even coming in as a rookie, you know, we would go to cities and, you know, other guys would want to, you know, go hang out or whatever, and you wouldn't see Kobe until the morning bus. And that's just how he was. He was focused on basketball. He was committed to basketball. He wanted to be one of the greatest ever, and he treated it like that. So, you know, I give him all the credit in the world. You know, his swag, his demeanor. I don't think he changed at all. I just think he got better and better and better because of the hard work he put into it. And, you know, when you're good at something and you feel that you're one of the greatest players, that's just automatic swag.
Mm-hmm.
It's automatic.
Nick, what of his skill set, of his athletic skills, what were the things that really stood out to you early in those years? Again, as you saw him as a teammate and probably had to play against him in practice, what was it that Kobe did or the skills that you were just, wow?
The skills that I was wild about was him being his size and being able to dribble like a point guard. You know, that was not, I wouldn't say unheard of, but it wasn't many players like that in the league at that time that can just flat out just give you the Tim Hardaway crossover, the Isaiah Thomas crossover. He was doing it at his size, and that made him so much harder to guard because even then he kind of had like Jordan's cheating ways as far as getting by you, grabbing your arm, you know, the little tactics of getting to the basket. Kobe had that at a young age, and the ball handling definitely stood out for me.
So it sounds like you're almost saying that even at a young age, he had the mindset, the on-court mindset of a guy who'd had 5 or 6 years under his belt. If you're talking about being able to do some of the sneaky things, some of the underhanded things, sounds like he came into the NBA almost older than he really was.
Oh, it was no question he came in older than he really was. Well, I know one advantage he got. I used to have a buddy of mine, and I'm from the Midwest area. You know, right by Chicago, 45 minutes from Chicago, but I'm from Wisconsin. And I had a buddy who was, you know, diehard Bulls fan, and he taped everything Chicago, whether it was local news, I mean, just everything. So, you know, I would get these VHS tapes back in the day, and they were like 4 hours long, but all Michael Jordan, just flat out, just straight Michael Jordan clips. And so I would bring them on the plane. I used to have a bunch of highlight tapes of all kind of sports, football, boxing, all kind of sports. And I had two VHS tapes, 8 hours long, and I let Kobe borrow them. And I never got them back. and when you talk about it, it's things that people probably never seen of Michael Jordan. And I think Kobe just, he literally studied that. And everything that he did, that Michael Jordan did, you know, Kobe did. The way he walked, the way he chewed his gum. And, you know, people used to always say, well, why is he copying MJ? Be his own man. I mean, if MJ was the greatest player of all time in basketball, why not copy one of the greatest, you know? I mean, that was just a no-brainer. And Kobe didn't care what people thought. You know, Kobe, you know, walked, talked, everything like MJ. And, you know, he patterned himself after one of the greatest players of all time. And to me, that's hard to do because you got to have a talent, you got to have a skill set, and you got to have a mind willing to do that and willing to put up with criticism with people saying that you're not him and you're not this and you're not that. Kobe didn't care about that. Kobe's will was to win championships, and that was Michael Jordan's will, was to win championships and prove every night that I'm better than you, and both of those guys did it great.
Hey, Nick, how much of what we've seen from Kobe this year is a result of just time catching up to him or the game itself maybe changing and maybe getting away from Kobe a bit?
I think it's more time more than anything. It's more time. I mean, we've all heard the saying, Father Time always wins. Father Time is always undefeated. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, Kobe's had a great career, 20 years, and it's hard to play 20 years at that position. You know, it's easier for a big man to go 20 years at that position, but the way Kobe played has to use his speed, quickness, athletic ability. You know, these guys now, you know, DeRozan, LeBron, you know, these guys are athletic. And it's all about father time, nothing else. His mind, he's still one of the greatest. He probably can see the game just as great as anybody else that's out on the court right now. But, you know, it's just all about that body.
Nick, it was great of you to do this today. Thanks so much.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
Nick Van Exel is head coach of the Texas Legends, the Dallas Mavericks D-League affiliate, played with Kobe in Kobe Bryant's early years. And some great insight, some absolutely great insight in Kobe Bryant. Love the line about how he, even at a young age, adapted some of, he called them, quote, Michael Jordan's sneaky ways about how he'd always give you a little tug when he went by you. And it's a terrific insight on Kobe Bryant. We are going to have a roundtable, by the way. When is Kobe's last game in Toronto, Travis? Kobe's last game in Toronto is Monday. So we will have a roundtable, special Kobe Bryant roundtable. And I think maybe we should rack that interview up and some of the lines from Nick, play it back for Jonesy and Eric and the guys when they join us. It'll be a Kobe Bryant roundtable on Monday. If you heard our conversation earlier with Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet.ca, you heard Ben and myself talk about Barry Bonds, and the word is out there that Barry Bonds is talking to or is interested in, or the Miami Marlins are interested in or talking to him. However, the two sides are interested in coming together and have Barry Bonds be the hitting coach for the Miami Marlins. This is an interesting marriage on several levels, not the least of which is that it's a remarkable step out of your comfort zone if you are Barry Bonds. It's one thing to be a coach in San Francisco where folks have your back, where you played for the organization. It's another thing to leave that cocoon and that safety net and go clear across the country to a team that has known its share of turmoil for the past 3 years. It would be a remarkable move by Barry Bonds. I would argue maybe a more remarkable move by Barry Bonds than by the Miami Marlins. Clark Spencer covers the Marlins for the Miami Herald. And Clark Spencer will join us when the Jeff Blair Show continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Send us all your money. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher, and we'll send you a free subscription for Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Absolutely free. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, you've been hearing about him all morning, Garrett Sparks. He will join Hockey Central at noon today. A rare day in Toronto, man. Happy, 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 happy. Over-the-top happiness. Leafs happiness. Just because it's nice to have that story to cheer for. Like I said, start of the show. Who cares where it goes? Just enjoy it. Have fun with it. Enjoy it. Don't build the kid up too much. Just take it for what it's worth. I mean, Leafs fans, you got to figure the hockey gods owe you at least, 500 of those? You got to figure you're owed maybe 1,000 of those sort of brief minutes of hockey happiness that in the long run really probably don't amount to much, but allow you to get up the next day and go, wow, that was fun last night. So Garrett Sparks will join Hockey Central at noon. I don't know what was more surprising about this story, that Barry Bonds may be joining the Miami Marlins as hitting coach. My first reaction was, why the hell would you do that? My second reaction is, because it's the Marlins, why not? But then Bob Nightingale of USA Today got me thinking, and Bob covered Barry and knows Barry and Bobby Bonds, the family. And he made the point that perhaps the most surprising angle in all this wasn't that Barry Bonds would want to get back into the game. It wasn't that somebody would offer Barry Bonds the chance. It was that Barry Bonds would actually consider leaving the Bay Area in order to go back into the game full time. Now, you think back to Mark McGwire, who was essentially persona non grata in baseball until he went back to the St. Louis Cardinals as a coach. The St. Louis Cardinals, the city that he played in, the city that always had his back. Now he's gone on to be a coach, or now he went on, he has gone on to be a coach with the Los Angeles Dodgers. That makes a certain amount of sense. Of course, St. Louis would have Mark McGwire's back as a hitting coach. They had his back as a player. He remains a very popular personality there. Perfect, perfect way to get back into the game. Barry Bonds is thinking, we are led to believe this report, of going clear across the country in order to pursue this job. And even if you do want to get back into baseball, which is ultimately what I think this might be about, you want to get yourself back in the good graces and perhaps open an avenue somehow that might allow you to eventually get into the Hall of Fame. It just seems odd. It seems odd to go clear across the country to do this. Clark Spencer covers the Marlins for the Miami Herald. Clark Spencer joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. Hey, Clark, I can't say, like I said, I went through three different thought processes when I first heard this story. What was your reaction to it?
Barry Bonds was looking to get back in baseball. The last uniform I expected him to be wearing to do that or to accomplish that would be the Marlins uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Really has no connection whatsoever to Miami or the Marlins. Just seems really kind of an odd fit, but looks like that's probably going to be what's happening.
It's an odd fit, but, I mean, if any owner was going to try to make an odd fit work, it would be Jeffrey Loria, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's been known to do this. I mean, he likes to hire coaches. I mean, he hired Tino Martinez, the former Yankee first baseman, a few years ago as a hitting coach. He really wanted Ozzie Guillen here as manager 4 or 5 years ago. And of course, that didn't work out very well. But it's not surprising that I'm sure Jeffrey is, this kind of has Jeffrey's name written all over it. And I would assume that's the case here.
How surprised are you as someone who's covered baseball that Barry would leave that security blanket of San Francisco to come here?
I heard you all talking about this a little bit earlier. Kind of leaving the cocoon, as you say, of San Francisco. But, if you're going to get back into baseball and you want to do it as quietly as possible or without as much commotion or fanfare, I mean, this in a way makes a lot of sense because, as you know, there's not the media spotlight in Miami on baseball as there are in other cities. And, there isn't a huge following with the team. I don't think there would be much backlash to it here, whereas there might be in other places. And from that standpoint, I think it does kind of make sense. What I find hard to kind of formulate in my head is, how is this going to work? I mean, ostensibly he's going to work in tandem with hitting coach Frank Menachino, who has been their hitting coach for the last couple of years. I mean, what's Barry's role going to be? Is he going to get down on his knees in the batting cage and do flips to these players? I mean, because people don't realize, I mean, I think most people assume that the hitting coach just stands behind the batting cage during batting practice and kind of takes it all in and maybe offers a word of advice here or there. But what they don't know, there's a lot of menial tasking to the job. I mean, you've got to be in the cages with those guys. You got to go out to early BP with them. You got to sit down and study video with them.
You got to pick up the balls.
But to pick up the balls, I mean, is Barry going to really do this? I mean, I don't know what the role is. Is he just going to simply stand there and impart his wisdom? And he has wisdom. I mean, no matter what you think about him, the guy was a great hitter, and I'm sure he has a lot to offer as far as that's concerned. But the Marlins already have a couple of guys, special assistants, Andre Dawson and Tony Perez, who already sort of do that anyway. I mean, they're not with the team, for all 162, but they're there a lot of the time, and those guys are pretty, they're pretty smart dudes, and they have a lot of advice to give. Andre Dawson in particular has been very helpful to young players, telling them what they should expect and to deal with. And so is Barry going to do that, or is he going to get down on his hands and knees on a dirty batting cage and do flips for John Carlos Stanton or Christian Yelich or D. Gordon or whoever?
My thought here was, what happens if he says one thing, Frank Menachino says the other, and you're a Marlins player, go, yeah, but Barry, Frank told me to do this. Barry goes, really? How many home runs does Frank Menachino have? You really want to go there? Like, I just don't, yeah, I don't see how this is going to work out.
Yeah, that's a valid issue. How is that going to work with two guys? And, you know, especially a player of Barry's stature, we're not talking about a guy who was a lifetime fringe utility player, which Menachino pretty much was. I mean, this guy's the all-time home run king. And, you know, how's that going to work out? You're right.
In conversation with Clark Spencer of the Miami Herald, this is always an intriguing team, maybe more intriguing than they are successful. And I've always kind of thought, Clark, that the Marlins, given all their young talent, should frankly, in the past couple of years at least, have been a little more successful than they've been. Where's this all going? Like, where's this Giancarlo Stanton, Jose Fernandez? Where's this all going, Clark?
Well, I mean, they locked up, as we all know, they locked up Stanton to a 13-year contract last year. It was the richest contract in North American professional sports history, which was, you know, at least a positive sign. They locked up Christian Yelich, their other young outfielder, on a long-term deal. They're working on an extension right now with D. Gordon, who you know, was the last year's batting and stolen base champion. So they're showing some positive signs in that direction. But their minor league system is absolutely barren. It was probably the worst in the majors last year. I mean, all four of their top-level minor league teams finished in last place, so they don't have anything on the way coming up. But, I mean, actually, I think, you know, they underperformed last year. I don't think they were a playoff caliber team like a lot of people did, but I thought they should have been around a 500 team. And with Jose Fernandez anchoring the staff, remember, he didn't come back last year till around 1st of July.
Right.
So they'll have him the whole season this year. They need to go out and find a couple more pitchers, starting pitchers, to kind of buttress the rotation. But I think they'll be halfway decent. They're still the third best team in the NL East. I mean, yeah, they're behind the Mets and the Nationals clearly, but they're clearly ahead of the Braves and the Phillies, who are rebuilding. So they have an opportunity to, you know, kind of make some noise. But, you know, they have not been to the playoffs since 2003. That's the second longest postseason drought in the majors. I think only Seattle's gone longer. And they haven't had a winning season since 2009. But, you know, they're in a new ballpark. The All-Star game is here next year. I think they feel they have like a three-year window, and that three-year window is kind of built around, you know, the length of time they expect Jose to remain a Marlin. I mean, it could be 2 years. I mean, it could be 3 years. But that's where how they see it, and they like their core position players. So, I mean, overall, I think they're headed in an okay direction, and, you know, it's not as bad as maybe things kind of looked on the outside.
As far as Jose Fernandez goes, is there any truth to any of those reports about tensions between him and some of his teammates and him and the organization? And I mean, even if there is, as I look at the pitchers out in the free agent market right now, even if very quietly the Marlins are contemplating trading him, and I don't know if they are, Clark, I'll bow to you in that area. But man, it would be such a hard market to try to trade him in right now with guys like Price and Greinke out there, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I just don't see them trading him at all. Like I said, they need to bolster their rotation with the number two or number three starter. And the last thing they need to be doing is trading not just a number one starter, but an elite number one starter. And talking to people in the organization, they're not going to happen. I mean, they're not trading Jose Fernandez. There has been some tension. I think some of it's been exaggerated, but it does exist with him and maybe some of the members of the organization. But you know what? He's under contract, and you know they have him under team control for three more years. And I mean, I don't see him going anywhere for at least 2 years.
And what is Don Mattingly's first responsibility, or the first thing he's going to have to do with this team this year?
Well, I mean, you know, he's got to, you know, he I think he comes in with a lot of respect. I mean, you know what happened last year? They fired Mike Redmond in May and brought in Dan Jennings, a guy from the front office. And, the players looked at that askance, like that was a weird move. You're bringing a front office guy into the dugout, into the clubhouse, a guy with no prior experience in that any capacity like that, as a player or as a coach or as a manager or even as a bat boy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Mattingly brings instant respect, not only for what he did as a player. I mean, heck, you know, a lot of these players don't even probably never saw him play as a player. But, you know, he's obviously managed the Dodgers, and I think he comes in, and I think in his own quiet, methodical manner, he tries to instill a winning attitude in these guys, and they haven't won in a long time.
Clark, it was great of you to join us, as always. Good to talk to you.
All right, Jeff. Anytime.
Be well. That is Clark Spencer of the Miami Herald. As always, the Miami Marlins providing plenty of grist for the offseason rumor mill. I tend to agree with Clark. I cannot imagine that the Marlins would seriously contemplate dealing Jose Fernandez. And I would just think, just looking at the starting pitching market right now, with Zach Greinke and David Price still on the market and Jordan Zimmermann off the market, absolutely. Would Jose Fernandez exact a huge price from another team? Oh, my God, of course he would, just as Matt Harvey would. And Matt Harvey's another guy. I mean, that name's kind of been out there. But I think if you're both of those teams, you're probably going to wait until next year to move either of those two starting pitchers. And you probably want to maximize their value and maximize the market timing by waiting until next year as opposed to putting them out on the market right now. But who knows with the Marlins? Ask Jose Reyes about life with the Marlins, where the owner tells you, yeah, go ahead and buy a house, man. You're here for a while. And then ends up turning around and signing off in a trade that sends you to another country. So the Marlins always providing interesting talking points. Barry Bonds being put into that environment is just, it's just got disaster written all over it. As I said, just think, he's going in as a co-hitting coach if he goes there with Frank Menachino. Frank Menachino is not his assistant. He's going in as the co-hitting coach. Who are you going to listen to? Frank Menachino? Barry Bonds? I'd love to be there the first time that a hitter has to go to Barry and go, well, yeah, Frank's got me working on this, and now you're telling me to do this. Yeah, that's going to work out. That is it for the Jeff Blair Show today. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same channel. Hockey Central at noon is next. We have spent a lot of the morning talking about 22-year-old Garrett Sparks. Of course, he made Maple Leaf history last night. First Maple Leafs goaltender to earn a shutout in his NHL debut. Mike Babcock has already said that if James Reimer's healthy, he will go in Winnipeg tomorrow night. But if not, it's going to be Garrett Sparks. He's the talk of the town this morning. And Garrett Sparks will join Hockey Central at noon, along with Jason York, Montreal Canadiens color analyst. So stay tuned. Hockey Central at noon is next. And we'll talk to you again tomorrow. Have a great day, everybody.